Hello and welcome to the Vote Her podcast, because when you vote, great things can happen. I'm Mara Davis, media maven, talent booker, publicist, gal about town, and I am ready to talk some politics.
I am Jen Jordan, former state senator, former person who ran for office a lot in the last few years, but I'm not now, and I'm an attorney and like to talk politics with these ladies.
And I am State Representative Terry Anulowitz, and I am probably not as well-rested as Jen is because I am in the middle of a primary campaign right now. Early voting has started, and it continues through the 17th, and Election Day is May 21st, and make sure you vote.
I have to tell y'all that I used to know those dates cold. Like, I would know when, where, all that. I'm like, I'll see a sign that says, vote here, and I'm like, well, people are voting? Like, what are we doing? So, anyway.
Oh, people are voting. Although my next door neighbor posted in our neighborhood Facebook group page yesterday. She was like, hey, I had no idea there was an election happening. I just walked by the community center and went in and voted. I'm like, woman, you live next door to me. Have you not seen my yard? I have three political campaign signs in the yard right now, one of which is my own. The other, I will say, is for Eric Allen, who is running for Cop Commission District 2. And the other is for Carl Bowers, who is running for re-election in the state court judge in Cobb County. I was like, you walk by my house every day. We live next door to each other. And she's like, oh, yeah, I didn't even see it.
And you live in a cul-de-sac.
I live in a cul-de-sac.
Oh,
that is true.
So, Terry, you won an award, which I was excited about. And Terry, by the way, dear listener, I wouldn't have said, like, Terry probably wouldn't have told us if I didn't see it on your Instagram story. So tell us about that award.
So I am very honored to have earned, actually for the second time, the Junior League of Atlanta's Legislator of the Year Award. And I have been a member of the Junior League of Atlanta for more than 20 years, almost 25 years, actually. And the Junior League of Atlanta, if you're not familiar with it, no matter where you live in Georgia listening to this, or if you live outside of Georgia and you're listening to this, hello. And also, there's probably a Junior League somewhere near where you live. But the Junior League of Atlanta was founded more than a century ago by Isolene Campbell, by the way, if you're a Cobb County person, because Smyrna is the center of the world. Her family is who Campbell High School was named for. Because they had their country estate out here in Cobb County, but founded more than 100 years ago and is really targeted towards women and children's issues, and specifically literacy, housing stability, healthcare. It's a group of pretty powerful and well-connected advocates. A lot of people in the halls of power in Atlanta, especially corporate, but elsewhere, have been members of the Junior League of Atlanta. They're very influential, and they really put a lot of their effort this year behind, of course, literacy, early childhood. They work closely with GEARS and Voices for Georgia's Children, but they've also worked closely with my colleague, who also got a Legislator of the Year award yesterday, Casey Carpenter from Dalton, Georgia, because Casey has worked relentlessly on safe housing issues. So, yes, I got that award yesterday, and it's always, you know, I mean, you'll get an award from time to time. Getting an award from a group that you belong to is, I think, very meaningful, because you know what the standards are, you know how. You know, I always am so impressed by all the people who I serve with there. And so it was nice. Thank you. It was a lovely luncheon. And I shout out to Cynthia Audain, one of my dear friends from Agnes Scott, and who is also a Junior League member. And she was my date for the event.
That's so great. Congratulations.
Thank you. I love that.
Okay. Now we're going to shift gears a little bit. It's been a crazy week. And that is, as we've all watched on TV, these protests that are breaking out all over the country. And we've had quite a few of them locally here at Emory, definitely part of this firestorm. And it's been really hard. It's been really hard and uncomfortable and complicated and frustrating. And, you know, I think we all have a lot of big feelings on this. But one thing that I keep seeing, like, as a takeaway as it comes to Democrats, people are like, oh, this is, you know, really hurting Democrats. And my whole thing with this is I feel like I've said this, and I want every all of us to weigh in, but I've said this all along as far as, you know, we're all standing up against anti-Semitism, and there's been some horrific stuff that's been going on at some of these protests. Some of them have been perfectly peaceful protests as well. But the anti-Semitism warriors, I applaud them, but I feel like, where were they before October 7th? And, you know, how did Democrats do a better job calling out some of these electeds who are selective in what they're calling out, like when propaganda is showing up at your doorstep, you know, those flyers that were put out around, or some of the hate speech from Marjorie Taylor Greene or Congressman Mike Collins. I mean, there's been some pretty terrible stuff that's come out. So it's just, and it's also like saying stuff. And for me, like, I've avoided saying anything on social media. This is, I feel like it's a space, safe space on this podcast, because it's just, you can't win. It's like, there's no winning. So it's, I want to, and that's pretty much how I feel about it. It's just so rough and messy. What do we do? What do we make on it? Go ahead and take this. Jen, you first.
Yeah, I think it's hard. And I think it's hard even to call out kind of folks who are convenient, you know, warriors against anti-Semitism now, right? Because it suits whatever their political ambitions or their posture is in the moment. I think it's hard because when people are doing the right thing, you don't want to call them out for it, right? Like, it's like, great politician, you're doing that now. Where have you been? But I mean, the reality is that anti-Semitism is a problem. It's a significant problem. And even if, you know, we have some people just kind of finally dialing in, or maybe thinking that it benefits them politically, because we know that's probably really what is pushing it. It's like, at the end of the day, you have to welcome all allies or people who are doing and saying the right thing, even maybe if they're doing it not, you know, for the best reasons. I mean, so, you know, I'm not really, I just kind of file it away in the back of my head, but I'm not going to call anybody out for it either.
I don't know. Sorry, I did.
I know, we go back and
I know.
It's different if it's like a full-on look. I mean, it's different like if I were running against somebody and it was like full-on battle, right? It's like I've run against people who have done some things that were anti-Semitic, I thought. And so in that instance, if I were running against someone who I knew specifically had done or said some stuff, and then now maybe conveniently they're coming around, yeah, I would totally point that out. But I think just kind of generally, right, all of a sudden, you know, you're wrapping yourself in this kind of anti, you know, crusader against anti-Semitism. You know, I think it's almost like we need as many people fighting against this as possible. So I don't know, Terry, what do you think? I mean,
I think I keep going about this in the framework that I've been talking about it with my children. And that is that most situations, lots of things are going to be true at the same time. And I think this is an, unfortunately, a really awful global scale example of how lots of things can be true at the same time. Like, I know, you know, going out, you know, getting to the sort of the micro in Cobb County, and I serve at the state level and not the federal level. And I have to really consider, okay, what is the highest and best use of my time? Is it, you know, foreign policy or federal policy, or is it, how is this impacting my community? And I know that anti-Semitism is real in my community. And I know this because, you know, way prior to October 7th, we had Nazis waving flags in front of synagogues. We had people broadcasting Nazi slogans on overpasses. I have, you know, this legislative session. So after October 7th, I got addressed to me in my PO box, the Goyim Defense League hate mail. You know, I don't know if they sent it to everybody or if they just sent it to everybody with certain sounding last names or what, or how they did this. But we know anti-Semitism is real. We also know that there's a humanitarian crisis happening in Gaza right now. We know that's real. We know that aid workers have been killed, you know, I believe accidentally, but that doesn't make it any less of a of a catastrophe, and it doesn't mean it doesn't add to the conflict. I think it's hard for a lot of people to talk about it. I think because it's hard for a lot of people to talk about it, they're choosing not to engage in the dialogue because it is so complicated. I mean, you have the geopolitical stability aspect of this, where if the United States does withdraw support for Israel, what does that mean for Iran? And then what does that mean for Russia, right? Because we know that they're working very closely, and Russia seeks instability in the Middle East, as does Iran. So you have to consider, like, all of these things are true. We have to consider all of these things. And I think a lot of times when there doesn't seem to be a lot of room for nuanced dialogue and discussion, when everyone seems to be seeking a binary, it's either A or B, I think it is oftentimes very understandable that people might opt out of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's just watching these protests have been so hard. And, you know, listen, you can absolutely pinpoint the media coverage, where a lot of people have said, I believe Chris Hayes did a monologue on MSNBC, like, we should really be focusing on what's happening in Gaza as far as the actual news story than talking about these protests, as in, like, focus on what this is all about. So certainly this is not going away, but as it affects the election, I just don't know. I think students are going to be leaving school at some point. I mean, it's going to be something we'll have to watch when it comes to the conventions this summer, the Democrat and Republican convention.
Well, and that's just it. A lot of this, I mean, and that's kind of what we saw at Emory and mm-hmm. all over the country. You have these folks that are coming to universities and doing these encampments that are not students at the universities, right? Now, do students then engage? Absolutely. I'm not saying that that's the thing, but there really are outside agitators. And I don't say that to necessarily malign them, because that outside agitators does kind of sound like I'm making some assumptions about them, but that's what they're trying to do, right? That's the whole point of protest. It is about agitation. Mm-hmm. It is. So, and they are coming from the outside. So it's one of these things where I think it's been a learning curve for a lot of these universities, and they're still dealing with it. Obviously, you've got Columbia, UCLA, the issues, but you can really see kind of what happened at Emory and kind of the not so great, you know, how that was dealt with versus at the University of Georgia, which the administration there seemed to have dealt with it in a much better way, at least from the optics that came out of it. Now, that may have come about because of what happened at Emory, right? Like, oh, we don't want that. But also, you have to think about Emory in terms of their student population, which is so significantly Jewish, right? That, you know, you could see the administration being much more sensitive to students there on campus feeling unsafe, you know, when you have outside agitators coming to campus, right? So there are some different things kind of at play, but this is definitely a learning moment for all of us. And we are a country that does value free speech. And even if we don't like the speech, right? That's the whole point. Right. If we don't agree with the speech, we don't like it. Again, that's the whole point of this, is that it is about kind of bringing to the surface things that people are kind of putting their head, you know, in the sand about. And so if nothing else, you know, I think that makes it worth us paying attention to for no other reason.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we'll definitely have more episodes to talk about this. And it's actually really nice to talk to the both of you and feel in a safe space, because sometimes you just don't feel like you're in a safe space. All right, moving on. We have two elections, which we talked about. And Judge McAfee is running for re-election, and District Attorney Fani Willis is running for re-election. And I point out the two of them because the Inman Park Festival was last weekend, and they were both in the parade, and seemed to, you know, people were into it. From what I heard, I know people that were there and definitely noticed them. And that's a very popular place to campaign for Fulton County, for the city of Atlanta. And so what do you both think of these two, and how's it going?
So I think it's interesting, because I will tell you that the Inman Park Festival and that parade, usually, absolutely, you have Democratic candidates, right, that show up. But a lot of times Republican or conservative, I should say, candidates, they're not going to Inman Park, right? So you got to give McAfee some major props to show up. I mean, he's a Kemp appointee. He, look, there's never been any bones about it. Like, he is a conservative. He, Federalist Society, I'm sure, all the things, right? All the things. But I think that the difference is that we have been able, we have watched him, right? We have watched him work. We have seen that he's handled himself well. And he is doing the best that he can to really make sure that the defendants are receiving appropriate due process, that he is holding the DA's feet to the fire, right? Although he did not disqualify her, that was not a very nice pat on the back order in terms of not disqualifying her. It's like, I'm not going to disqualify you, but, you know, let me lay out some stuff you need to consider here. Right. So you got to give him some mad props for showing up and, you know, for being in a place that usually would be a little uncomfortable with folks with his profile.
But let me ask you, what do you think his age plays into that? He's 34 years old. And so he's in a demographic of folks who, regardless of their political leanings, might, you know, they're probably spending time, I'm profiling the youths here, but, you know, they might be spending more time on the Beltline, and they're doing, you know, they're going to the, you know, I mean, I wonder if that has anything to do with it also, is that he's not, you know, some gray haired old jurist who, you know, he's young. He's got, you know, he's like doing young people things. He's a millennial.
No, I think, so this is what I really think, right? Like, especially lawyers or judges or whatever, they're not going to show up to anywhere where they think they're not going to get support, right? Like, politicking as a judge is super uncomfortable anyway, because you're not supposed to make certain comments. There are all these ethics rules and kind of stuff. And then you run into people who, I mean, he's a superior court judge. I mean, he's doing like murder trials. Like, the last thing you want is like the guy you just sentenced, you know, or his family, all this kind of stuff. Nobody, these judges generally aren't out there politicking like this. I think he has gotten some serious support across the political spectrum, which then leads us. And I think we saw that in terms of a fundraiser that, you know, that he just had, that they put in, you know, that was the AJC wrote about. I mean, Terry, did you see that?
Oh, so I was going to say, what do Fani Willis and Judge McAfee have in common besides the whole case? And that is that Roy Barnes is a big supporter of them both. Roy Barnes, former Governor Roy Barnes, you know, he was at, this is in the AJC, he was at the event for McAfee this, you know, last night, so Thursday, for those of y'all who are listening to this next week. And a couple weeks ago, Roy Barnes hosted a fundraiser for Fani Willis. I mean, it's the legal community, and Jen can speak to this better than I certainly can, but it is these judicial races are nonpartisan. And that's the biggest difference between Fani Willis and Scott McAfee. If you're a Fulton County voter, if you're a Fulton County voter, it doesn't matter. Well, so if you're a Fulton County voter, if you want to vote for Fani Willis to show your support for Fani Willis as DA, you have to pull a Democratic ballot.
That's true.
But if you are a Fulton County voter, it doesn't, for Scott, as far as Scott McAfee is concerned, it doesn't matter if you pull a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot. Those nonpartisan judicial races are on every single ballot that everyone's voting for. And in fact, you can pull what's called a nonpartisan ballot, which only has, sometimes people who don't really understand how Georgia primaries work, they'll get really mad because they'll like, why, I don't really belong to either party. I want a nonpartisan ballot. And then they are surprise when they're only able to vote on a bunch of judges, because
they're like, what?
They're like, what? Yeah, I didn't declare. They get hopping mad. I will get phone calls on election day. Jen, you will get phone calls on election day. I pulled this ballot and no candidates I wanted to vote for were there, just a bunch of judges, which is also why it is kind of unusual to have contested judicial races, because they are on the nonpartisan primary ballot, which is a very low turnout election and tends to be, it's interesting because primary voters tend to be much more educated because they're making the effort to vote in the primary, which most people don't do. But I know people ask my husband all the time who he vote, because most people, unless you're a lawyer, don't really know what these judges are doing. And I think McAfee is the big exception to that because he is at this national and international level case.
Yeah, he got, global press because of this. So in a weird way, did DA Fannie Willis help his campaign by giving him so much TV time?
Some things, and like one of the candidates in the primary with Judge McAfee basically said when he qualified, like, yeah, I'm qualifying to run, but how hard I campaign depends on how he rules on Fannie Willis. And it's like, that's a choice. Like, that's a really bold statement to be like, I'm going to qualify to run for this, and I'm going to see how you rule on something to see how hard I run against you. I mean, that is unusual.
Yeah, I just, listen, I thought it was cool. And then here's some insider info. You and I, the three of us have talked about it, but I know somebody that dated him, the judge, in high school. And let's just say, like, his reputation is that he's a really good man, that he's a good guy. I mean, they're not together now, but it is funny. And I only bring that up and I won't say the name, but it is true. I've seen the pictures. And it just goes to show that Atlanta is a really big city, but also it's a very small town. I mean, that's that. People just know each other here. So we wish them both the best. Moving on. As we're on the topic of judges, I was picking, well, Jen and I had lunch this week, Terry. You were campaigning. It was a last minute thing. And I was getting into Jen's brain about this whole Trump, Judge Mershon, New York City, Stormy Daniels, National Enquirer thing. And I was asking about the contempt of court. Like contempt, he's breaking the gag order. And I was just curious, since we're talking about judges, I was so fascinated on how a judge decides to make these decisions and how they rule on that. So Jen, can you weigh in on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think what we were talking about specifically is, and this is kind of where, this is where I would come from as a judge. And I think this is one of the biggest things, which is, A, you have to hold parties in contempt when they, time after time after time, they flout your orders, right? Because it is one of those things where that is the whole rule of law, right? Like, people have to follow the rules when you're in a courtroom. You have to follow the law. You have to follow the orders of the court. The parties do, because if they don't and you don't do anything as a judge and kind of hold them, hold their feet to the fire, then other parties see that. And then, there's chaos, right? It's just like being a mother and having children. You can't sit there and tell your children, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, or there are going to be consequences. And then there are no consequences. And so it really is about it is about the rule of law and about just making sure that when people go into the courtroom, it doesn't matter who you are, we are all subject to the same rules. We're all subject to the same kind of institutions. And so I don't give a flip that he's the former president of the United States. I mean, he of all people, should want to make sure that, the rule of law is upheld. And I think the problem with Trump is that he's never been that way, that all he cares about is himself. He doesn't care necessarily about the court system, the judges, the law. He doesn't care. He doesn't care about it. And he basically just likes to give everybody the finger. And he's been able to get away with it time and time again. And I'm just glad that with respect to this judge, I mean, it may not seem like much in terms of like the $1,000 or whatever. But look, I think we saw that it really did start to make a difference, because there were posts that had been up that were pulled down almost immediately after these orders started to come out.
Would you ever want to be a judge, Jen?
Oh, I would love to be a judge.
Here comes the judge.
To be a judge. Let me tell you something. I would love it. I would love it. But the problem is, in terms of being a judge, is that like there are some really cool things you do, but then there's some really hard things you do. I mean, like, for example, Judge McAfee, in terms of the Superior Court, the Superior Court is where the death penalty cases are. The Superior Court is where really tough divorce cases are, or custody, taking kids away from family, all those things, right? So judges are so incredibly important. And that's why, you know, it was funny. Terry was talking about people always ask her husband, he's a lawyer and all this. A lot of times people skip the judicial races because they're like, I don't know. I don't know who these cats are and whatever. And it doesn't really matter to me. I will tell y'all that judges are so incredibly powerful in terms of the decisions that they make. And if you ever actually engage with the civil or criminal justice system, you get that. And that's why lawyers pay attention, right? Because they get that, man, who these people are really does matter. I just really wish that everybody kind of got that before something bad happens to them.
Okay. I want to go on to the next topic, and that is, I'm going to go right to you, Terry, since you are a proud owner of a new puppy.
I have as many dogs as Jen has now.
Maybe I'll get another one.
Maybe, if the ordinance allow.
I feel like this is the only story in the news lately that can actually bring Democrats and Republicans together. Like, really, it is like the one thing that has united both parties, and that is Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota, who I do want to recognize, who she's like claims to be the most pro-life governor. She doesn't allow abortion for rape or incest, not incense either. She has said that as far as like if it was rape or incest, we don't want to have one tragedy add another tragedy. So that's what she said. So we all know that she is in the news in her own book, not the fake media, not as any spin. She wrote it in her own book that she had to kill her young dog because it was not a good hunting dog. And it has made crazy news, like just clickbait central. But it's like, and then she also killed a goat accidentally. And, you know, this poor dog attacked some chickens, which happens with wild dogs and hunting dogs. This is their job.
It's a bird dog. It's yes. Literally right there in the name. Like, it's a, I mean, I have three bird dogs, and while they have never been around chickens, I imagine they'd be pretty intent on the chickens if they were, and they're sweet dogs. But yes, so back in 2002, my husband and I got married, and a few months later, we got our first dog, and we took that dog to a trainer who had been recommended to us. This is in your neighborhood, Mara Highland Pet Supply. Used to be right over there on Amsterdam. Now it's over there by the Beltline, kind of behind Pont City. And the first thing the trainer did, his name is Ian. He's amazing. We've got to take baby girl dog to him soon because she's about ready to be, all trained up. He recommended a book. He's like, everyone should read this book. And the title of the book, I hand to God, don't shoot the dog.
Wow.
And it's not titled that because they're like, people, surely they're not going to shoot the dogs. But it was, it's like that because, and it's really a book, not even specifically about dog training. If you want a book specific to dog training, I highly recommend The Art of Raising a Puppy by the Monks of New Skete. But Don't Shoot the Dog is really more about how you train yourself to own your dog and to have your dog, because your dog is basically just responding to you. I mean, your dog they're responding to you. So I imagine, yeah, if you're Kristi Noem's dog and or goat, you might be a little cranky because, you know, you you have to live with Christy now. But yeah, don't shoot the dog. And she clearly didn't read that book. And I don't know what she expected out of a bird dog. Why would you put a bird dog around chickens? It doesn't make sense. But I don't, like, and this is the thing, how far we've come. Because remember when Mitt Romney, we found out he'd put the family dog in a crate on top of the station wagon? And we're like, he's unfit to serve. And honestly, having grown up in a very large family where we would put six kids and a dog, sometimes two dogs, in the Ford Country Squire station wagon, I don't agree with putting the dog's crate on top of the station wagon, but I see how you get to that choice. Like, I can see the thought process. You're like, okay, we got to get all these kids and all this crap and all these dogs in the car. We can't put a kid on top of the car. Maybe we put the dog. Like, I see how you get there, even though I don't condone it, nor would I choose to do that. But shooting the dog in the gravel pit right before your kid gets home from school and is like, where's Cricket? That is depraved.
Do you think her political career dead?
Look, there are so many levels of bad here. Like, apart from the fact that she shot Cricket, I mean, and the dog's name is Cricket, like, it's just awful, right? And then it's not even like somebody dug it up and like, oh, it's like some negative, like, oppo on her. She freaking writes it in her own book. It's like, who the hell is this lady? Like, she is like Sarah Palin 2.0 and not even like an upgrade. Like, I'm like, I love it because it really does kind of reveal who she is, right? And I hope, oh man, I hope that Trump picks her as his running mate or whatever, because, you know, that would just be like, oh, that would be awesome. Because anybody who shoots a dog named Cricket and then lives to tell about it, you know, and spreads it far and wide, you know, isn't fit for office. So, and I apologize for that rant right there.
Well, no, I mean, we need justice for Cricket, right? I mean, we need bumper stickers that say, maybe that could be the title of this episode, Justice for Cricket. And we also need to all send her copies of either Where the Red Fern Grows or Old Yeller, you choose. You
know, oh my gosh,
Where the Red Fern Grows, because I guarantee you, she probably had to read that book in elementary school just like everybody else our age did. And she was probably like, yeah, they had it coming.
Yeah, she's a really craven, horrific individual. But my favorite is how she's doubling down on it. But here's an interesting fact, of course. There was a poll done, because of course there's a poll on everything. And of course, all the Democrats were like, basically like, this is horrible. This is in the Washington Post. But among Republicans, the split was narrower. A quarter members of the party said the action was acceptable. And another quarter said they weren't sure. Just under half found it unacceptable. So there you go. This goes back to the kind of cult mentality. It's just like, but I am refreshed to see that even like some super hard right, like, you know, nut jobs like an Eric Erickson is tweeting, saying, you know, a Megyn Kelly, you know, they're just like, justice for Cricket, you know, we're like, all right. You know, so we're all sort of bonded on that. I mean, she sucked to me beforehand. I just think, you know, if you're that gross on reproductive rights, but now we know, you know.
Well, and her whole thing, she's like, well, you know, I'm willing to make the hard choices and do the hard work. It's like, no, you're just too damn lazy to train your dog.
Yeah, she sucks. She sucks. Yeah. And oh, by the way, have you ever seen there's a like a side-by-side photo of her, like of what she looked like before she got everything done to her face? And she looks like a completely, like how she became magnified, where she got the cheek implants and she clearly maybe got a nose job, or she's got the big...
Well, not only that, what's crazy about it is that I think she went to Texas and got all this plastic surgery and then like put it all on her social media about how she had to go to the best plastic surgery, you know, center in
endorsements,
Texas.
Endorsements. She's doing commercials.
Yeah. Like, and she literally probably got it for free. And it's like, You had to leave your state to find a plastic surgeon? Like, the whole thing is just icky, right?
Well, it's weird. And that has to be a campaign finance violation. Like, that has to be an FEC violation, right? Like, pay for play with a boob job? I don't know.
It was the play. Like, and like, you know, and now it's like, and Dan Cricket? Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I were the plastic surgery center, if I'd want her even associated with me.
I know. It's, well, she was a commercial for veneers, and it's because she's got those big, giant teeth. So, listen, Kristi Noem, no sympathy. I don't know that she, you know, she was probably on the top of Trump's list as far as who she was going to choose, but I think it's, if it's women, it's Elise Stefanik, or she's probably in the running. And they're
she's gross.
They're all so gross. They're so tacky.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders, though, if you're going to go with a woman, she's probably the best. I mean, don't get me started on her.
I'm thinking about that dress she wore with those cowboy boots, and it was so unfortunate.
I mean, this is, you know, nobody's going to like anybody. Okay, let's get to our final segment, and that is, what are we raving about this week, Jen?
So I am raving about, well, there are a few things. I've been listening to the podcast that you had told me to listen to, and it was good, right?
Beyond All Repair is what it's called. Yeah.
And it really is very well done. The journalist did an incredible job. The only issue was, like, at the end, it was like, ugh. Like, it just didn't have, like, this ending that was nice and kind of wrapped everything up. So but you know, that's the whole point, right? That's the point of journalism and these things, is to make you think. So I'm raving. Everybody should listen to that just because it was so, so well done. But the second thing is a book I'm reading called Real Americans by Rachel Kong. And it is really, really good. And so I think everybody should check it out.
Oh, I'm adding it to my queue right now. Okay, Terry, what are you raving about this week?
So I have actually read some really, really excellent books lately. I read The Sicilian Inheritance by Joe Piazza. I read The House is on Fire, which it's one of my favorite books I've read this year. And of course, I can't remember the author's name, but I'll post it somewhere. But it's about a theater fire in Richmond in 1811, told from the perspectives of four survivors. And it is, you know, one who is a woman who was there and who realizes these men weren't as chivalrous as they thought. One, an enslaved man. He becomes a hero. One who is an enslaved woman who realizes this might be her chance to escape if they think she died in the fire. And one is someone who was partially accidentally responsible for the fire. Great book, great book. And I'm also raving about Sudafed because something's blooming this week and it is doing me great harm. And I'm always been a big believer in the real Sudafed, the kind you have to show your driver's license for. Sudafed, if you're listening, you can sponsor us. I never believed in that other non-driver's license kind. It never worked. So thank you, Sudafed.
Okay.
Well, neither did the meth heads either, Terry, but whatever.
Terry's a little Breaking Bad over there.
Oh, I go to CVS. I'm like, I need the meth kind, please.
Okay. I am raving. Well, I'm always raving about podcasts, but I'm going to do it twofold. One, I'm going to rave about the podcast Bone Valley, which I've talked about for years, because Leo Schofield was released from prison. He's in a halfway house. And so if you
it's
listen to
incredible.
That, it is incredible. The work of Gilbert King and Kelsey Decker were the two journalists on that. And full disclosure, I did work on publicity for that podcast, but it is an extraordinary story. And it's just amazing that journalism was able to move the needle in that way, to get an innocent man or a man to, even though it's complicated and there's a lot more to it, because he wants to have his charge overturned, but he is out, and that is great news. The other thing is I want to give it up to the Biden-Harris campaign on their media strategy. I think it's been really savvy to put the president on like shows like Howard Stern and SmartLess and to have Vice President Harris was on Earn Your Leisure when she was here in Atlanta. And so I think that's savvy. And Jen's got to go.
I got to go. I got a baby girl to pick up.
Okay.
From school. Because that's how we roll in the ATL.
That's the Vote Her podcast, baby. All right. Everybody vote for Terry. If you're in Terry's district, get out there and get and you know, press that button or touch that screen. I'm pointing.
Tap it. Tap it hard.
Just tap it. Tap Terry.
Tap that screen.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next time.